it's good to connect this way. It's a bit of a, that mixed feeling that one wishes to be in person. And after, even though all these years in the UK, we met so many Americans. It feels strange. I've never been to the States, and it feels strange to have so many American friends. And at the same time, you don't know, you haven't been to the country, but you feel like you have, even though you haven't. It's a strange thing. So I hope one day can make it there. But yeah, we are in the southern part of Brazil, the southernmost state nearby the border. If you know a bit of the geography of Latin America, the border with Uruguay and Argentina. So in a region that we call the Pampas, where the gauchos traditionally live, so the sort of cowboys of South America. So if you know anything about Argentinian beef, that's what we got here in the south of Brazil as well. So we are in this small town. It's of German background. So this year we are celebrating here in the south of Brazil the 200 years of the German immigration. And yeah, we live in this house here in this small town, but nearby the capital city of our state, Porto Alegre. So it's a reasonably big area in terms of population. So over 4 million people live in this area. But again, we are in a small town. And in the work of Labrie, yeah, we have weekly dinners where we welcome people here every Tuesday for an open discussion in the Labrie fashion, as you know it well. And we have on some Saturdays of our terms, we have a lecture in the morning, and then we invite people for lunch. They stay over for coffee, good coffee, by the way. And then we carry on into the afternoon in conversation. So tomorrow morning, my wife Lily, she'll be lecturing, will be welcoming people here in our home. And occasionally on Thursdays, we have films and we watch them together and discuss as well. So we're hoping, praying, and waiting on the Lord to see if the Lord willing, this work will become a residential. But we're doing the work of Labrie and waiting and see what happens. Okay? Right. So I will then begin this lecture to go through, I'm hoping, in about 50 minutes an hour, just so you know. There's a lot here to be covered on this topic. And even though, thank you, Jock, for the kind introduction and giving me the credit for and to speak on this topic, but I must say it's a massive topic, and I feel like I'm scratching the surface of it because there's so much there. So I want to be humble as well before this topic because there is a lot to be covered. But I hope to give you a sort of panorama of the discussion and point out to some possibilities of us thinking about this theme of the social sciences. So shall we begin? And I'll begin. And whenever I have especially in England, when I had a difficult lecture to deal with, I would bring this quote from Hans Rukmacher, the founder of Dutch Labrie, an art historian. And I'm taking this quote out of context, just so you know. So this is the context of his article on what is reality, but I found it so helpful when dealing with difficult topics. So I will use for this lecture once again. Rukmacher says in his article, by way of introduction, and I make his my words. So let's read it. So my experience is that the things I deal with in this lecture are very, very difficult. If it takes you 20 years to understand them, you are very quick. I have no solutions to the problems I'm raising. It is something that we have to work on for many years to come. In fact, it is the task of the coming generations, plural, to reflect on these questions. If we are able to answer them, we will have found the key to the solution of a lot of the problems and tensions in our Western culture. So I think this quote applies to this topic of the social sciences. You see the complexities of it, but I hope to give you a good panorama and we can have a good discussion following the talk. But this is the map. So this is the road that we are riding on tonight. So in the very beginning, I will have three basic statements, three, I'm calling here three propositions. And then I will give you just a contemporary panorama landscape of where we are in terms of the influence of the social sciences, in especially on the so-called, within sociology, the new social movements, right? And then part two, we will think about this idea that Jock mentioned briefly, even this idea that this movement of this change from philosophy to the social sciences, and again, a very recent thing that has been taking place. And one could say, well, maybe early 20th century, but really now consolidating itself towards the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st. And I am putting forward this idea that this one of the reasons why that happened, or in fact is happening, not the only one, but a central one, is because of the of naturalism. And we'll talk about that. And then I will present the case of sociology. And I have to say that we are talking about the social sciences as a whole, but I will focus primarily on sociology. Every now and again, I'll bring examples from social and cultural anthropology, but I'll focus primarily on sociology, even though the social sciences are broader than that. One could include political sciences and economy, even history, but it will remain within the field of sociology primarily. And then part four and five, I promise you, they are shorter. So if you get there, you're thinking, well, that will take a long time, but they are shorter, just so you know we're getting to an end by the time we get to point four, which is just basically thinking about responses from a Christian perspective, where we will see how different movements and traditions have done that so far and some ideas. And then I'll conclude with this idea of one reality, two cities, but how many sociologists? We'll see by the time we get there, okay? So this is the map, the road that we are taking on this evening. So my three propositions are these. Number one, and this will follow, right? I hope you keep that in mind. We'll come back to them later. But when an absolute is relativized, something relative becomes an absolute. Okay, it's my first proposition. The second one is that there is no meaning without reference points and relationality. That is to say that there is no meaning if things are not in relationship. So we cannot understand one thing without understanding the other. This is why we, even within Christian thought, we embrace the idea that things are very complex, because reality, God's creation, is very complex and is in relationship. Even to think about our own identity, we don't have time to go there. We have to think about ourselves in relationship. So meaning is connecting to relationship and to reference points. And number three is that at a fundamental level, religion is the way meaning is organized around an absolute. And by religion here, I don't mean merely the institutionalized religion, but I mean very much this idea of a basic belief where we put our trust. So we put our trust in something. And it might not be God, it might be something else. But in whatever we put our trust, there is our religion, and there is our absolute. So these are the three propositions that I begin with that will give, so to say, the north, the sort of reference point to my talk, the framework, and we'll go back to those through and through and towards the end. So a bit of the panorama. So as I mentioned before, we can really see in our day and age the prominence of the importance of the social sciences. If you think, for example, historically, even within the field of theology, the main partner of theology within its study and even setting up themes or in dialogue with theology, historically, it has been the field of philosophy. But lately, and especially in the 20th century, we saw a change. So it's not that philosophy is not there anymore, it is, but we see that the social sciences, particularly sociology, has been taking the place of philosophy, even in as a partner of dialogue with theology, with Christianity. And within the, say, the broader church, if you think even within the Roman church, we see that consolidating, especially in the 60s after the Second Vatican Council, where you see, for example, the development in Latin America of perspectives of theology such as liberation theology. We'll go back to liberation theology later, but that has a strong connection with sociology and its field of production of knowledge. So we see that in the so-called theologies of the global south, where Latin America, perhaps parts of Asia, and even Africa, they emerge rising themes. And these themes, not only, but they have a lot to do with the themes that are worked on within the field of the social sciences, okay? So we see this change everywhere, even within theology. But we see that particularly in the movements that sociologists have been calling the rise of the new social movements, right? So that basically means the new social movements is that we don't have the social movements organized as they essentially were since the aftermath of the Industrial Revolution in the 18th century up to the mid of the 20th century around the issue of, say, social inequality. That remains a topic within the social movements. Yes, it does. But sociologists have identified a fragmentation and an explosion of different themes. Some people may call it identity politics, for instance. But the fact is that the social movements have fragmented in a variety of different perspectives and different centers, if you like. Okay, so you see, for example, the issue of race, and you are perhaps even more inside this debate, this heated debate in the States that I am here in Brazil, even though this is a huge discussion here as well. But you see that, for example, in the rise of the issues of the LGBTQA+ movement lately, with even the fact that the letters of the movement have been added up every now and again, it means that more demands, so to speak, from society have arisen, and they are normally channeled through the social sciences, right? So issues of race, issues of gender, and you see, do you know this face? I think you do, right? That's Greta Thunberg, the Swedish climate activist. So issues to do with the environment have become part of the new social movements as well. And obviously there are a variety of fields that will deal with them, but again, you see them channeled primarily through the social sciences. And this is a novelty, because even though philosophy would think about these things, but it wouldn't be the prime concern of philosophers, right? So you see that, for example, this is a movement called the Extinction Rebellion. I don't know if they made it to the States, but they're very much active in the UK. Even though now they morphed into something called Just Stop Oil. You might have heard of them. So they have the sort of protest that they kind of close roads and they don't want cars to be on roads. And sometimes some protests, the people went to art galleries. And so to call attention, an interrupted sports event, to call people's attention to the climate issue. But they are all part, there's one more picture of them, to do with one part of all of them, even though their cores and their center, their claims may be different. If you think about race, gender, climate issues, but sociologically speaking, they're all part of the so-called the new social movements. And they are part of this new panorama where the social sciences have a very, they're very much at the center, at the central stage of society, of what's going on and what makes to the news, right? That these issues are all over the place. If you might not be familiar with sociology, you might never have heard or read anything by an academic, but certainly when you turn on the TV or you browse through social media, you read something, the themes dealt with within sociology, the social sciences, are there all over the place, right? So this is one of the reasons why it's so important for us to think about that. Is it clear thus far, this brief introduction? Thumbs up. Okay. Am I making myself, yeah, understood? Great. Okay, let's move on. So one question, one possibility of exploring this would be to ask the question, what happened? Why? Why we are seeing the replacement, if you like, of philosophy and the growth of the social sciences, right? Well, one could say there are many ways, and I believe there are many dimensions that one could approach that phenomenon from. But I would like to focus tonight and on this material on a brief history of philosophy and how perhaps even within philosophy we saw a way of interpreting things arise that gave birth, in a sense, to sociological thinking. And my thesis, not only mine, other people's thesis as well, is that perhaps naturalism is the bedrock, is the foundation, is the framework that gave the social sciences the possibility of existence, in one sense, okay? Or at least not of existence, maybe that's too strong, but of taking such a central stage, or taking such a central part of our lives and the lives of our Western societies, right? But would be very important. I think here Francis Schaeffer is very helpful, because he has this, and I mean, we don't have time to explore it, and I don't know how familiar you are with Francis Schaeffer's understanding his history of philosophy. But one thing that's important for us is to understand that his interpretation and others, like the Dutch philosopher Herman Dooyeweerd, you have this idea that in the Middle Ages and early modern times, you have this dualistic way of thinking that basically divides things, the world and reality, between nature and grace, right? And Schaeffer explored that, and he focused primarily on Thomas Aquinas and on his synthesis between Greek philosophy and Christian theology. So basically, you have this idea throughout the Middle Ages, especially in medieval theology and philosophy, that reality would be divided between nature and grace. And in this upper story that Schaeffer's call it, the upper story, there will be the world of the supernatural reality. So if you have, we all live in nature, but it is possible to access the realm of grace and to touch supernatural reality, but supernatural reality is beyond nature, so to speak, right? And the world of nature will be the world of autonomous reason. And for Schaeffer, even that was kind of the reason why natural theology developed, this idea that you can think with your natural and the autonomous categories of reasoning, you can come to truth without necessarily the aid of revelation, for instance, right? And you have philosophy operating within the realm of nature, and you have theology in the realm of grace, so to speak, very roughly. This is very simple, but just for us to understand the general picture, right? And this is what Francis Schaeffer says in Escape from Reason. So bear with me, it's a long quote, but bear with me. He says, in Aquinas' view, the will of man was fallen, but the intellect was not. From this incomplete view of the biblical fall flowed subsequent difficulties. Out of this, as time passed, man's intellect was seen as autonomous. This sphere of autonomous growing out of Aquinas takes on various forms. One result, for example, was the development of natural theology, as I said. In this view, natural theology is a theology that could be pursued independently from the scriptures. Aquinas certainly hoped for unity and would have said that there was a correlation between natural theology and the scriptures. But the important point in what followed was that a really autonomous area was set up. From the basis of this autonomous principle, philosophy also became increasingly free and was separated from revelation. So, in his analysis, Schaeffer's analysis in Escape from Reason, he says that the development of that such a dualistic perspective on nature and grace The outcome of that was, in modernity, was that nature swallowed grace. In a sense, the realm of nature grew and grew and grew, and the realm of grace became very tiny, cornered, in a sense. So in that perspective, in modernity, you see, for example, the growth of that idea that religion is just a private dimension of human life, right? So, for example, they would defend that, well, when you come to the public sphere, you should use your autonomous and your religious, should be free of religious ideas, right? To use your reason, your neutral reason, right? And probably you heard that argument before, right? So say if you're a Christian, you come to a public debate, and if you mention anything to do with religion or God or faith, people say, well, but we are in a lay state, or I would say I've got the word now, but when the state and religion are not the same, right, connected. So you have this idea that if you come to public spaces, you should use a different tool, autonomous reason, right? So this is Schaeffer's interpretation. So the realm of nature became kind of overwhelmingly big. And that this is basically the process that some philosophers, sociologists, theologians call the process of secularization, right? So you stop seeing the world and you stop seeing transcendence in the world, and all that you see is nature, right? So we see that as a consolidation in modernity, right? So the ideas of human personality, humanity would be within the realm of nature. The idea of science would be interpreted only exclusively within the realm of nature. So this is what one could call naturalism, that you only see the causes of everything within nature, right? Some people call it, Francis Schaeffer called it, a closed universe. So you cannot see anything that goes beyond the closed universe. The Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor called it the immanent frame, right? So it's not transcendent. You just see what is immanent, what's present, what's around you. Another way of saying it, this is a materialistic view of the world. Everything that exists is things that you see. There's no supernatural reality. There's no transcendence, right? So in a sense, the development of Western thinking, Western philosophy, if you like, created that such a worldview of a closed universe, of life within the immanent frame. And for some people, and this is one of the definitions here that some people work with, it might be a powerful interpretation, that in one sense, sociology might be the philosophy of the immanent frame. And I say that as a sociologist, and I think there's a way out, but I think this is one of the arguments. The social sciences, they become the sort of new philosophy of the immanent frame of the closed universe. Right, but let's move on. Just so you know, this is very interesting. As we talk about this replacement of philosophy by sociology, this is very interesting to think about how the main schools of sociology, how they view philosophy. Right? And if you study this, the history of sociology, and I'll mention a few authors in a minute, but primarily you have to think about the French school of sociology, the German school of sociology, which is primarily divided between Max Weber and Karl Marx, right? So you have the French stream of sociology and you have the Marxist stream of sociology. Look at that slide. French sociology views philosophy as a stage of history to be overcome. Isn't that interesting? So if you think about Emile Durkheim, I don't know how familiar you are with these authors, but I'll show their names there, just in case if you need to take notes, and I can give you to Jock and James the slides if you want to have them and have a look again later. But within the French school of sociology, which is grounded in the philosophy of positivism, and I don't have time to explain it here, but they basically saw that we should abandon both religious thinking and philosophical thinking to give place to a new form of thinking, which would be what they call the scientific way of thinking, the sociological way of thinking. In fact, one of the proponents of this sociology in France in the late 19th century, his thesis was that sociology would become humanity's new religion. That was his aim, that sociology would become humanity's new religion, right? So on the Marxist way of thinking, philosophy was and is perceived as a way of analyzing reality, but not changing it. And if you think, well, Marxist thinking is very much to do with the concrete world, so to speak, the praxis, changing things. So in Marx's interpretation, up to his day and age, philosophy has occupied itself about thinking and analyzing, and he was proposing something different. He proposed a social philosophy, sociology, that would be a philosophy of concrete, real action. So you see, in both schools of thinking, there is a negative interpretation of philosophy. One of the reasons why, perhaps another reason why, we see this replacement of philosophy by sociology. Okay. But if we were to think, to define, what defines, what is the difference between philosophy and sociology? And again, you have to think that in the 19th century, when the social sciences were put together, they are very young sciences, they were defined as sciences. And I know there's a lot of debate there. Some of you might be from the so-called hard sciences, right? And there are critiques from both sides. But the fact is that the social sciences, they claim to be scientific. But look at that slide. Traditionally, I know there's room for discussion here, but we think about philosophy in terms of a discipline, not science. We don't define philosophy as science, right? We tend to think about philosophy in terms of prescriptive discipline that thinks, for example, about the field of ethics, right? How we ought to act in the world, for example, right? So it's a normative field that thinks and has implications for the way we act. There's a strong emphasis and on the subjective side as well, and it deals with meaning. So philosophy connects things, so different fields of knowledge, the meaning of life, the meaning of existence, the meaning of living together, right? Traditionally, science, in all its manifestations, has been defined as a more descriptive field of study, right? So it deals with things that are more objective, with methods, with repetition, with things that are empirical, with data, if you like. So it deals with the realm of facts. So this is why people say, well, you cannot just take a science and want to extract a meaning without a sort of philosophy to inform it, right? But that's the paradox of the social sciences. It was born calling itself a science. But this is the point. This is part of my thesis as well, is that in fact, it acts and it is in the world a philosophy. Right, because it deals with meaning. It is normative. It is highly subjective. So the social sciences, as I said, were born claiming to be scientific. However, and I mean, I'm not talking about all the development and schools of sociology, right? Specifically looking at its birth in the 19th century. However, when they assume the social dimension as the most fundamental reality, an absolute, remember my propositions, they operate as a philosophy, introducing a new metaphysics, dealing with meaning within a closed universe, abandoning, therefore, their proper field and colonizing other areas of life and knowledge. Okay, this is my central point tonight. So, in fact, what is happening, not with all sociologists, not with all sociologists, but a lot of the time, sociology claims the social dimension as the most central one. Why? Because we have lost the perspective of the transcendent world. We live in a closed universe, as Schaeffer said, in the West primarily, within the immanent frame. And in a sense, in a strange sort of sense, sociology becomes a sort of metaphysics of the immanent frame. Okay? So this is my point. And I look forward later on to hear you, if you disagree with that, your questions, your comments. And I would love to hear you. Right? Let's move on. Okay, are we okay so far? Yes? Great. So let's move on. Just in case you're not familiar. So as I said, I'm talking about the social sciences as a whole, but I'm really focusing out. I want to now talk about the case of sociology in particular, right? So these are the founding fathers of sociology, okay? You have two Frenchmen and two Germans. Auguste Comte and Emile Durkheim were very close together and part of the same movement called positivism, right? Very influential in France and very influential here in Brazil as well. If you look at the Brazilian flag, what you have there, order and progress, was a motto of the positivist movement. And this is a topic for another lecture. But the proclamation of republic in Brazil was all done by the people that were very much drinking from the positivistic philosophy. And then you have Karl Marx, perhaps certainly the most well-known of the sociologists, even though, just to observe, he wouldn't have called himself a sociologist, right? He was a political economist. That's how he was known back then. When the discipline of the social science were organized later on in the early 20th century, he was kind of included in the stream of sociology, but he never called himself a sociologist. Differently from, say, Emile Durkheim or even Max Weber, right? But just so you know, this is a kind of the founding fathers of sociology. Emile Durkheim, his most important works, The Division of Labor in Society, and his book on suicide, A Study in Sociology. Very interesting. I really recommend reading these two works. But Emile Durkheim is the main representative of the French school of sociology. And is very much at the heart of modernity. And this is where the kind of sort of social imagination of modernity comes to place. Because Emile Durkheim and the French school of sociology were all about progress. So it was the philosophy of progress. And in a sense, he divided the history of the world in terms of an evolution that goes from mythology and religion, so superstition and the beliefs in all sorts of gods, including the god of Christianity. He says that explicitly, and kind of moves to a more refined way of thinking through metaphysics and philosophy. But he says philosophy is not enough. We have to get to a scientific stage, very much in line with modern thinking. But then he would say, well, sociology is the most modern and the science of the day that answers the questions that modern man is asking. So he borrowed the methods of, and he, at the beginning, he didn't call it, very interestingly, he didn't call it sociology, but he called it social physics. Because again, the most scientific of the day were certainly physics and chemistry and biology. So he borrowed the name and called, well, in the same way that the physics, they look at the laws of the universe, and the planets and what happens in terms of the world, we are now looking at the sociological laws. And he really believed that this progression from mythology to sociology was a deterministic law in the same way that, say, the Newton law was operating in the world, okay? So, and then he borrowed all the methods from biology, even so much so that Emile Durkheim called his metaphor for society was the social body, well, this is a language that even the Bible used, right? But he used this idea that we are all different organs, that are all members connected. And then he would use, say, oh, I'd say the state and religion and ethics and the arts and law and economics. They are all like members that are connected. And he was called, because of his methods of the from biology, of function, the way it was thinking, that the school of thought was functionalism. Every single thing in society has its particular function, so it functions in a particular way, coordinated. So he believed that this new science would be neutral and very objective, so deal with facts, with data. That's what he believed. But again, a very negative view on philosophy. But just a parenthesis here, just for us to think, a question that up to this day, people working within the social sciences ask themselves, how objective and neutral a social science can be? And I know this is a huge discussion, right? And I just bring the case, I don't know if you're familiar, this guy there, sitting there, is one of the most famous anthropologists, Bronislaw Malinowski. He was a Polish anthropologist that he studied in the States for many years. And I forgot now where he taught in the States, but I can confirm later to you that information. You can check. One of the big universities. But Bronislaw Malinowski, he was a pioneer in terms of doing the social sciences, and one of the tools that anthropologists particularly use, it's called ethnographies, where they go to particular places and they live with people and they observe their way of being, and from that observation, they elaborate theories and ideas, and they describe how these tribes live. So Bronislaw Malinowski, in the beginning of the 20th century, he went on and off to the islands called the Trobriand Islands, just off the coast of Papua New Guinea, right? So can you imagine traveling there? And he established contact to different tribes that were never contacted by Western white people. So very pioneering work, right? And it's very interesting to read his book. I have his book here, in fact. Where is it? It's upstairs, but it's such a big one describing the life and society. And if you read it, sometimes it's a bit boring because it's very kind of scientific in a sense, right? Full of data and the way he observed. But the question that many people have asked, even him, is that how objective a subjective person can be, right? If I go to a particular group of people and observe them, can I really be objective if I am subject observing other subjects? And interestingly enough, I think it was like 10 or 15 years after Malinowski's death, they found, one of his students found, kind of clearing some of his stuff at university, a sort of kind of secret diary or kind of Malinowski. And with permission of his wife, even, it was published. And it's very interesting that there he just basically describes his troubles being there with these people and his anxiety and how some bad thoughts he had about the natives there and some lustful thoughts he had about the women there. And sometimes he would say he hated those people and he didn't know what he was doing there. The fact is that sort of kind of was a big thing in the social science, just to raise that sort of question. Can a social science be absolutely neutral, right? And I think most people today would say no. And the answer wouldn't be to try to be absolutely neutral, because this is, in a sense, would be impossible, right? But just that's one thing that we can come back perhaps in our discussion. Well, Marx is on the other side. Look at what he says in one of his books called The 11 Theses on Feuerbach, a German philosopher. Quote, The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it. Interesting, isn't it? His view of, again, philosophy is creating a new thing. And the opening, and I really recommend, if you never read the Communist Manifesto of 1848, just read it. It's very short, very easy to read. He says there, the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. Free man and slave, patrician and plebeian, lord and serf, guild master and journeyman, in a word, oppressor and oppressed, stood in constant opposition to one another, carried on an uninterrupted, now hidden, now open fight, that each time ended either in the revolutionary reconstitution of society at large or in the common ruin of the contending classes. And here we have, we could open up a new window, but you see some sort of kind of new way of interpreting the world sociologically, and a new sort of social imagination. And I mean, we don't have time, I'll skip this, we can come back. This is a classic way, the classic Marxist view of reality, right? Basically, in a nutshell, it's base and superstructure, which means that for Marx, to change society, you have to change what is at the base. It's not enough to change what is up here. So what is up here for Karl Marx is a mere kind of reflection, of what is at the base. So we need to change the relations of production, how labor divisions organized, and then you have effective change, right? This is his way of thinking. But again, you see a primarily sociological way of interpreting everything. Great, okay, we're getting to the final part of the lecture now. Are you following me? Still there? Okay, so part 4 and 5 are the shorter, as I said, okay? And I hope it's making sense. Right, so how can we sort of respond from a Christian perspective? Or even you could say, if a Christian is studying sociology, how does one see sociology now? Or if you're talking to someone that is going to the field of sociology, Christian or non-Christian, how do you see it? Is there any validity? Is that a legitimate field of study? What's going on? So very briefly, I want to present to you 3 possible ways of people that have taken different paths when responding to the contemporary social sciences. One of them, the first one, is assimilation. Second, rejecting it altogether. And third way would be some sort of critical dialogue. Okay, so an example of assimilation, as I mentioned before, would be liberation theology. Okay, and I've done some study on liberation theology. I don't know everything about it, things that I need to study still. But if you read, for example, A Theology of Liberation by Gutierrez, one of the founders of liberation theology, you see that liberation theology is a theology of the praxis. And even though it was born in Latin America, let me tell you, if you don't know that, it's all over the place in the States, right? We have imported liberation theology there. So if you never heard of that, you are dealing with that right now. We can bring that to the discussion later on. But in its articulation, it sees sociology as a way of reading reality. So all the authors operating within liberation theology, they say they come to the world, to reality, to society, if you like, and they interpret reality with sociological eyes. And I must say, primarily from a Marxist foundation, and they then apply the theological response to what is wrong. But in a sense, sociology is responsible for reading reality, becomes sort of their worldview, and then they apply theological knowledge there, right? So in that regard, the language of structural sin is there. Okay. So I would say this is a fusion of sociology and theology right there. And personally, I would say I don't think this is a good way. But I'm open to hear you. If you have a different opinion, I'm open to discuss it, right? This is assimilation. The second perspective is a sort of rejection. And here I'm using the British theologian, John Muhlbeck, and his famous book that I highly recommend, Theology and Social Theory. And at the beginning of the book, he says this: all sociology, including Weberian sociology, turns out to be positivist, that movement that I mentioned. And this has implications for how theology should relate to sociological theses. In effect, theology encounters in sociology only a theology, and indeed a church in disguise, but a theology and a church dedicated to promoting a certain secular consensus. The final chapter of part two seeks to end the dialogue between theology and sociology. Look how interesting. Eubanks has brilliant insights in his books, and his perspective, sociology in a sense, would be, I'm interpreting him here, a sort of secular theology, or if you like, as I said in the beginning, a philosophy of the immanent frame. And in his perspective, should be completely rejected. A third way, and I would say the one that personally I'm more sympathetic towards, is some sort of critical dialogue. And you have the picture there of Herman Dooyver. If you haven't heard of him, we can discuss later. But it's a Dutch philosopher. And this is very much within the realm of Reformation of philosophy. So in this perspective, sociology is perceived as a legitimate field of study. So it's not for us just to, okay, now let's abandon everything that comes from the social sciences and sociology. He says, no, sociology is a legitimate field of study. But it should be differentiated from philosophy. They are not the same thing. They operate fields in different spheres, right? And he says that we have a diversity of different dimensions in reality, and reality has a social dimension. But the social dimension shouldn't take the central place. It's one dimension of life, but not the central one. Okay? So he defends this idea of a non-reducible ontology. And I hope this diagram makes more sense. We don't have time to talk about each one of these things here, right? But here you see Dooyver's articulation of this 15 dimensions of reality. Okay? So if you look at number 10, for example, here you see the social dimension of reality. But you have others. You have, for example, the arithmetic, the mathematic, the spatial, movement, mnematic, the physical, the biological, the sensitive, the logical, historical, linguistic, the social, the economic, aesthetic, the legal, judicial, ethical, and pistic, which is faith, trust. So Dooyver says that we participate as humans in all of them, but none of them should be central. Remember my propositions? Something relative shouldn't be made an absolute. Okay? And in his perspective, if the transcendent God is not at the center, you must have something else at the center, the theological definition of idolatry. And then you place one of the dimensions there at the center. And then you have a reductionism. Okay? Say, if the social dimension takes the central dimension, it will tend to interpret all the other fields in his own field of study, will be colonizing other spheres, right? It's, for example, say, if a sociologist goes and analyzes religion and says, well, religion can be explained by the social dimension. Well, there you have a reductionism. Or not only sociologists, take, for example, a historian. If a historian says, well, we can understand, say, ethics just by looking at the cultural dimension, there you have a reductionism. OK? okay? Because both culture, history, and ethics have their own place. The other diagram shows how they all interact, right? So you can't have a relative dimension at the center. And what it looks like it's going on our day and age is that the social science side are taking the center and sort of di dictating all and colonizing all different fields. Take, for example, biology. Even with the, I don't want to enter only this issue, but take the issue of gender, for example, right? Is gender something that, or sex something that's biological or sociological? Well, if the social takes place and is the central bit, even the biological dimension can be reduced to the social. But then you have a reductionism of reality, okay? So, in a sense, what happens is this. So, the absolutization of a relative always leads to reductionisms. So what do we need to do? We need an approach to sociology which is transdisciplinary, which means that, and I'll go back to this, right? Sociology is a legitimate field of study because the social dimension is part of reality. However, a good sociology is done in dialogue with other fields. See, if the social sciences cannot have a dialogue with biology, with physics, with logic, with religion, with economics, it cannot interpret reality. Because again, remember my proposition, meaning always comes in relationship. Things are related to each other. Okay? So, and we need to go beyond a social ontology of power. This is very much what we read in Marx. And we see, for example, in critical theory, which is one of the daughters of sociology these days, right? To come to imagine what would a Christian sociology look like. Great. Final bit. And I know that might be many doors and windows open here, but let's do it. As I said, it's a panorama. So I would say that's a way of thinking or a way out of this would be to think it from a Christian perspective is to think that we live in one reality. So as Christians, we should interpret the world with the lenses that Christ himself, we have the mind of Christ that he gives us, right? But we do recognize, and I'm using Saint Augustine here, that we sort of live in two cities, the city of God and the city of man. Okay? We live in the world created by God. We are in God's creation, but we are in a fallen world. So we are in this tension. Even the kingdom of God that has come in Christ hasn't come fully. That will happen when the new creation comes, when the new Jerusalem comes. We'll have the full realization of God's kingdom. So theologians call this tension the tension between the now and the not yet. So we are citizens of two kingdoms, if you like, or two cities, right? We have the city of man, and I hope you identify the picture there at the back, which is the Babel Tower. So us building reality, interpreting things according to our own devices. And what is the foundation of society in the city of man? Power. Okay? Everything's about power. Who controls who? Who? Oppressor and oppressed. Class struggle. Gender struggle. Race struggle. Everything's about power. And this is very much the taste of the sociology of the day, right? And then everything becomes about being objective or subjective. You have to choose. Extreme subjectivism or objectivism. And you see some sort of dualism between deterministic society or constructivism, the idea that everything is socially constructed, but almost in a deterministic fashion, right? But the main thing is that the foundation of the sociology of the city of man is power. And I think that we should embrace the idea that the sociology There is a sociology of the city of God, of the city of the kingdom of God. And the foundation that for us to be together, if you like, is not power, but ultimately is love. This is the way that God created us, and we are his image. And this is the Trinitarian view of the sociality. We are together because we need each other and we love each other. This is not to recognize that in a fallen world, and under the shadow of the fall, there aren't any struggles and power dynamics. Of course, there are. But we believe that ultimately, the foundation of reality is not power, but love. Therefore, our sociology it must be a different sociology. We cannot embrace a sociology of power, even though we can see power, but it's not the foundation, it's not our perspective. In a sociology of the city of God, we recognize that God's creation is both objective and subjective. We live in a world that is created by God, and it's objective, but we are subjects, so much so that God asked us to name the animals, and we name creation. And I don't have time to explore this, but there's plenty of freedom, plenty of freedom for our subjectivity. But the thing is, we are both objective and subjective, subjects in God's creation. And we are called to cultivate the garden. What it's called the cultural mandate. Go and cultivate the garden and expand the garden beyond Eden. So we are dealing with cultural issues, with social issues. So there is a place for Christian sociology. It shouldn't be abandoned. But again, we have to be aware. Are we doing the sociology in the city of God or in the city of man?